Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, June 13th, 2017. There's a lot of news to comment on today, starting with the championship Golden State Warriors defeating the Cleveland Cavaliers 4-1 in the finals. Many of us here had hoped that it was going to be a four-game sweep, but hey, we will take the big victory last night, 129-120. And it is, you know, I'm not a big sports fan, but there is a buzz. There is a lot of excitement here in the Bay Area as our team has come through again after losing in the championship to the Cavaliers last year, winning the year before. Well, as the old philosopher Meatloaf said, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. We lead the News and Comment podcast today with the announcement from Congressman Brad Sherman, the Democrat who represents Sherman Oaks in the Los Angeles suburbs of the San Fernando Valley. He has introduced a bill of impeachment against Donald Trump in the House of Representatives. Now, before we get into those details, I have some history with Brad Sherman. Here in California in the 1990s, when he was a statewide officer of the Board of Equalization, a tax review panel, he joined me in a campaign to repeal a snack tax that had been imposed by Governor Wilson to cover a budget shortfall. And in order to get our message across, we led a campaign of sending ding-dongs and other snack treats to legislators and the governor in Sacramento. And Brad Sherman and I won that battle. I don't know that it was the greatest political struggle in American history, but he and I bonded over that, and we also share the same bald-headedness. And Brad Sherman carries in his pocket a stack of combs with his name and website on them, and he routinely hands them out to people saying, here, I don't need this. So he's an interesting guy. He can be a grandstander. When the Big Five automakers came to Washington seeking bailouts back in 2008, he was the one who said, give me a show of hands. How many of you CEOs drove here today? And how many of you flew in a corporate jet? And of course, they all had to sheepishly admit that they didn't even fly coach on an airliner or drive one of their fancy cars from Detroit to D.C. They all flew on their corporate jets. So Brad is an interesting guy. I don't agree with him on some issues. He is a staunch Zionist and a big AIPAC supporter. But when it comes to domestic issues, he's pretty progressive. And I give him credit for being willing to take the heat from the majority Republicans and the majority of Democrats in the House who think that this is premature. Now, his resolution is narrow. It relates to the firing of FBI Director Comey as an act of obstruction of justice. And at least so far, the resolution doesn't infer that Russia hacked our election or, you know, manipulated it in favor of Trump or hacked the DNC servers. And so I can say that this is something that I could support. Now, Sherman knows that he has a long road ahead of him. A majority of House of Representatives members must vote in favor of impeaching a president, and then 67 senators must agree that the president is guilty and subject to removal. And in an interview with Vice News, Sherman admitted that if this goes forward, we would get a President Trump. But he believes that, quote, we got to protect the republic. This is not going to change the ideological direction of the country, says Sherman. Now, his African-American colleague from South Central Los Angeles, Maxine Waters, has been talking about impeachment, and I'm not sure why she didn't write her own articles. But Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi is reluctant to join these calls for impeachment, saying they don't yet have a public case and that they should hammer the Republicans on issues like Trump care. But Sherman said, I don't think the actions that I've taken are going to distract people from the fact that they're losing their health care. So this is a marker. It is the beginning of a possible process that could lead to the removal of the 45th president. But don't start betting on it. Don't get your hopes all jacked up, because it is a real uphill struggle. There is simply no question about it. And yesterday, MSDNC went absolutely bonkers. And you can trace the pattern here, the sequence of events. On public television's NewsHour, they interviewed Chris Ruddy, the chief executive of Newsmax, and a close buddy of Donald Trump. And Ruddy admitted that he hadn't talked to Trump about this, but that he believes that Trump is leaning toward firing the special counsel, Robert Mueller. Ruddy told Judy Woodruff, "I think he's weighing that option." And he made his own case that he doesn't think that there's anything to investigate. He thinks that Comey is too tight with Mueller, and they have a history of friendship going way back. There's no doubt that they have become political brothers of a sort. And to actually fire the special counsel, either the deputy attorney general, who is the acting attorney general for the purposes of a Russia investigation, his name is Rod Rosenstein, he would have to fire the special counsel. And if he refused, Trump could pull another Saturday Night Massacre like Nixon did. That's where he fired the attorney general and then the deputy attorney general and got down to the solicitor general, a guy named Robert Bork, who was rewarded for his staunch support of the Republican president by a nomination by the subsequent Republican president, Ronald Reagan, to the U.S. Supreme Court that was borked by Democrats. Bork never made it to the court. And the Saturday Night Massacre was one of those reasons. So it's fair to say that the Mueller appointment is not clean as a whistle. It is not above criticism or reproach. But if Trump decided that he's going to fire Mueller, he's got to be prepared to hunker down for a firestorm of massive proportions. But Adam Schiff, the leading ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, said if the president fired Mueller, Congress would immediately reestablish the independent counsel and appoint Bob Mueller. Don't waste our time, he says. But that's fanciful. That's wishful thinking. Adam Schiff does not control enough votes, does not hold enough sway to overcome the majority that Republicans hold in the House of Representatives. And to think that the Senate would also fall in line and reinstate the special prosecutor law, I'm sorry, that really doesn't hold up to any kind of rational analysis. So I mentioned Rod Rosenstein. He was up on Capitol Hill today, and he was actually subbing for Jeff Sessions, his boss, to nominally talk about the budget of the Justice Department. But instead, he got a rash of questions about whether Trump is considering firing Bob Mueller. He told senators that he wouldn't carry out any order from the president to fire Mueller unless there were good cause. Quote, "I'm not going to follow any orders unless I believe that those are lawful and appropriate orders. If there were good cause, I would consider. If there were not good cause, it would not matter what anybody says." So that's a pretty strong position. But it is not necessarily defining or controlling. He went on to say that the regulation there will be maintained and Mueller is going to have full independence to conduct the investigation. So we'll see if those strong words hold up over time. Meanwhile, Rosenstein's boss, the sometimes recused Jeffrey Beauregard Jim Crow Sessions III, made his appearance in a public session under oath before the Senate Intelligence Committee. And I've coined a new term for what he did. He didn't just testify, he testalied. And he got up there and danced around the issues. He got indignant at some tough questions from Senator Wyden, the Democrat from Oregon, who pressed him on a comment that came from Comey last Thursday, that Comey knew that Sessions would be recusing himself because of problematic behavior. And when Wyden asked him what that problematic behavior was, that's when Sessions got a little red-faced and said that this is innuendo, there's nothing problematic. But he didn't really answer the question. and that's why I call it a test-a-lie. And throughout it, he refused to assert executive privilege, which is what you have to do if you don't want to answer a question about your conversations with the president. But then he refused to answer any questions about conversations with the president. It was a maddening, circular kind of argument that certainly frustrated the Democrats on the panel. He stuck to the claim that the firing of Comey was all based on the memo that Rosenstein had written saying that Comey overstepped his role when he made the announcement that Hillary Clinton would not be prosecuted for the issues related to the matter of her email server, the actual investigation into that matter. There was also a sidebar that I have to take note of. Kamala Harris is the newly installed senator from California. She was our attorney general, and before that, she was the district attorney here in San Francisco. And as a former prosecutor, she adopts a questioning style that was used by many of her male colleagues on the Intelligence Committee. But it's only Kamala Harris who twice now has been upbraided through interruptions by John McCain because he feels that she keeps interrupting the witnesses, Comey last week and Sessions today. But Kamala Harris was about the 10th or 12th senator to ask questions out of the 15, and clearly five or six of them had peppered Sessions, cut him off, told him, look, I only have 5 minutes, answer the question, don't filibuster, including Tom Cotton, who asked him a friendly set of questions about his favorite science fiction books and whether this whole claim of Russian collusion with Trump would fit into the plot of a science fiction or a mystery kind of spy thriller. And then Cotton went on to interrupt the witness because he had squandered some of his time. But when it came to Kamala Harris, McCain was out of order when he interrupted her interruption of Jeff Sessions, and then the chair, Richard Burr, banged the gavel and said, the chair will be responsible. That was a brushback of McCain. But this is now the second time that this woman and person of color has been treated to a double standard. And yes, she is junior in seniority. She is a fresh person in Senate terms. But this is unacceptable. And I reject that kind of double standard and treatment of Senator Harris. The political hysteria in Washington has led to a bipartisan bad decision. What they're going to do is impose new sanctions on Russia and Iran. And because Trump hates Iran, they're going to attach the Russia sanctions to a bill imposing sanctions on Iran. Now, I don't know what behavior Iran is being sanctioned for. And I know that the Democrats in the Senate want to maintain the sanctions on Russia that Obama imposed for the allegations of interference in our election. And this is an effort to limit Trump's discretion to lift the sanctions against Russia or any other country. The new Senate sanctions would, put into law sanctions that were previously established via executive order, including some on certain Russian energy projects and debt financing in some industries. It would also impose new sanctions on Russians found guilty of human rights abuses, supplying weapons to Syria's government, and conducting cyber attacks on behalf of Russia's government. And I think that this is really, it's premature to say the least. We don't have public proof or evidence of the allegations that are asserted here, and this could have a really negative effect on efforts to work with the Russians on critical issues like Syria. And it's all driven by politics on both sides of the aisle, and I deplore it in both cases. The aforementioned John McCain, who is getting really more and more incoherent, was acting like a mad dog today as he took on the guy who holds the nickname Mad Dog, James Mattis, who is Trump's Secretary of Defense and a retired general. McCain has demanded a plan for winning in Afghanistan. And he chided Mattis because he was expecting it within the first 60 days of the new administration. And he's been told that maybe in July we will have a plan. And McCain demanded that they deliver that. He said, we want a strategy. I don't think that's a hell of a lot to ask. And unless we get a strategy from you, you're going to get a strategy from us. Now, all of this ignores the fact that there is no possible winning strategy in Afghanistan. We've already surged American troops there twice. And there is no, we are no closer to, you know, establishing a secure government in Kabul and pacifying the rest of the country. It is a fool's errand, and we will continue to pursue it. There's a good report from The Intercept today based on a new study released by the Columbia Law School Human Rights Clinic, saying that we only know about 20% of the total drone strikes that are conducted by the Pentagon and the CIA. And that while Obama used drones much more than Bush, the rate of drone strikes per month has increased by almost four times since Trump took over. And ask yourself, have you heard about all of these drone strikes? You can probably count on one hand the number of drone strikes that you've actually read about in the media, mostly in Yemen, since Trump took over. And the secrecy around the not-so-secret drone program continues to be a way of dodging accountability while we continue to create more problems by killing civilians and killing the wrong people in far too many cases. Every day I like to pause for a moment and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Julie Dupree and Casey Condon, they kick in $10 a month because they choose to. And Bill Goodacre, Jim McHugh, they're regular monthly subscribers. I need you to join them. I do need more subscribers here to cover the costs and keep this whole thing going. My servers aren't free, you know. So if you'd like to become a subscriber, please do. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, find the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. That takes you to the sign-up page where you've got options, and bonus books are displayed for new annual subscribers with a mailing address in the continental U.S. If you're a regular listener to this podcast, you know that I've been a sharp, persistent, and consistent critic of the FBI under Bob Mueller and under Jim Comey. And one of the cases that really opened my eyes to the bad deeds since 9/11 of the FBI is the Lodi Mosque case, where a father and son were prosecuted. The father was ultimately exonerated, but the son, named Hamid Hayat, who was 19 at the time and is now 34 years old, he's been behind bars ever since, he was framed by a paid FBI informant who was a proven liar. Because this FBI informant told his handlers that Osama bin Laden's number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri, had been to the mosque in Lodi, California. That was a complete fabrication. But they kept paying the informant until he framed Hamid Hayat. After Hayat went on a trip to Pakistan and was accused of attending a terrorism training camp. He said he played video games and met with family members in Pakistan, but he wasn't believed because he was a Muslim and because he had an FBI informant who was testifying against him. In a court order unsealed today, U.S. Magistrate Judge Deborah Barnes has written that Hayat's claims about his trial lawyer raise serious questions concerning the competency of the defense. And Bob Weisberg, a criminal law professor at Stanford, who I'm familiar with, he called the judge's decision significant. It's a pretty striking opinion, he said, very well reasoned. And this case goes back. I've covered it. I've talked to the lawyer who's now being accused of poorly representing Hayat. And it has always been a stinky case. The younger man was arrested in 2005. And the case was tried in the media when John Negroponte told Congress that the Hayat case was a prime example of a homegrown jihadist cell. And this has led to the propaganda campaign that has allowed the FBI to run roughshod over the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the First Amendment, almost the entire Bill of Rights, using its expanded powers under the Patriot Act to infiltrate and often provoke criminal behavior. I hope that Hayat is soon found innocent and released. Yesterday was one of the most bizarre cabinet meetings in the White House that we have ever witnessed. Now, ordinarily, there's a photo opportunity at the beginning, and the photographers come in and take pictures of the participants. They sit around the table and make small talk. And Trump decided to, well, get everybody he's appointed to a cabinet job to kiss his ass. This was bizarre.
So I think what we'll do, most of you know most of the people around the room, but I'm going to start with our vice president. Where's our vice president? Our vice president.
Greatest privilege of my life. And it's to serve as vice president to a president who's keeping his word to the American people and assembling a team that's bringing real change, real prosperity, and real strength back to our nation.
Deeply honored, and I want to thank you for keeping your commitment to the American workers.
I can't thank you enough for the privilege that you've given me and the leadership that you've shown.
We thank you for the opportunity and the blessing that you've given us to serve your agenda.
So after saying that he never asked Jim Comey to pledge allegiance, he got every member of his cabinet to essentially thank him for giving them this opportunity and pledging loyalty to him. This was a remarkable public setting, and it really shows the arrogance and the insouciance of the Trump monster. Interesting developments related to the immigration policy. The Washington Post is reporting today that the Trump administration has approved 17,000 new applicants for Dreamer status. That is DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. In addition, 107,000 people already enrolled in DACA had their two-year work permits renewed during the first quarter of this year. And that is, it's really good news. It's surprising. And it is a relief for many of the individuals who are in that position and couldn't figure out what Trump was going to do. But the people who are losing out are proven victims of violence in the countries that they fled who seek asylum in the United States. And the New York Times profiles an 18-year-old, well, he's a little older now, but a young man from Venezuela who fled his country after being tortured by the security agents in Venezuela. They put a gun to his head, attacked him with their feet, a golf club, a fire extinguisher, tortured him with electric shocks. So he fled to the United States, and as he was going into an immigration center for a hearing on his application for asylum status, he was instead met by two ICE agents who handcuffed him and took him to a detention facility to prepare him for deportation. And there are other similar stories, but the heartlessness of the Trump deportation policies is really showing in stark relief now. There's an interesting new policy, and it's perhaps coincidental. The timing of the announcement by the Senate Rules Committee announcing that reporters can no longer question senators as they're walking down the hallway or getting into one of those trams that moves them from their office building to the Senate chambers. Now, we're told that this is just to relieve congestion in the hallways, but the rule is that before you can film an interview, you've got to get a permit from the committee that senator is either going to or coming from. This is a new hurdle, and is, as I mentioned, it could just be coincidental, but this is being announced at the same time that the Republicans have a gang of about 10 or 12 guys, and they are all guys, who are hammering out the Republican health reform bill that will be taken straight to the Senate floor without any input from Democrats, without any allowed amendments. And it could be that this crackdown on media coverage is an attempt to allow these people to continue to conduct their business in private. Now, a lot of Democrats are piping up. Claire McCaskill, in a video that went viral on Facebook the other day, was challenging Orrin Hatch, the senator who is in charge of the relevant committee here. And he admitted, no, you're not going to get to have a hearing on this. We welcome your input. Just stick it in your ear. And so this is a murky development. And as I say, we can't prove that the two things are linked, but it could very much be the case. Megyn Kelly has gotten oodles of free promotion for her new Sunday night show on NBC. Some of it is boomeranging on her. She has booked an interview with Alex Jones to be broadcast this Sunday night. And among other things, he repeats his claim that the Sandy Hook school shooting was a hoax. And as a result, parents who have a nonprofit called Sandy Hook Promise have dumped Megyn Kelly from their fundraiser gala, which is being held tomorrow night. And Megyn Kelly is disappointed by this, but she defended her interview with Jones, saying that I don't agree with it and it makes me cringe, but that people need to hear about this. And I do defend her right to interview Jones. I find him a real nuisance because, as you may know, I have a few questions about Sandy Hook. I don't think it was a hoax, but the real-time media coverage of the event as it unfolded is not consistent with the story that has been settled on as the official narrative. There appeared to be another shooter, and I continue to ask questions about that, but I don't declare it a hoax, and I would never do anything to injure the parents of those who died there. But Alex Jones is a convenient foil because he can be trotted out and then dismissed as this fringe lunatic conspiracy theory promoter. And that allows a smokescreen to be placed over many issues that deserve further exploration, like the Orlando nightclub shooting, the San Bernardino shooting. I could go on and on. And so I'm in this uncomfortable position of once again defending the free speech rights of someone who I find despicable and detestable. And Megyn Kelly made her own choice on this, and she'll have to live with it. I'm linking to an important piece written by Lee Camp regarding the New York Times smear job on him in last week's paper. It was on Thursday. And Lee Camp, who hosts a kind of a combination Daily Show or John Oliver show, he's sometimes serious and sometimes funny. I've only watched it a few times, but I have respect for Lee Camp. And he happens to broadcast on RT, Russia Today. And so the New York Times, as part of its effort to ensure that we all, you know, subscribe to their approved conspiracy theories and nothing else, did a takedown of Lee Camp. And he's not taking it lying down, because he wrote a piece called How to Write Propaganda for the New York Times, as demonstrated in an article about me. And he takes on the reporter Jason Zinnemann, and he does an incredible job of showing how Zinnemann used a technique called priming. He used guilt by association. He lied provably about claims that Lee Camp is essentially, you know, a stooge for Russia or some kind of a Russian agent in our media. And I just want to take this last piece here. The New York Times article ended this way. It's covering a stand-up gig that he did in New York. Once Mr. Camp finished and the crowd had filed out, I lingered for a minute on the sidewalk. And while there wasn't any rally, that's referring to a joke. People, you know, if you don't like my performance, go out and stage a rally, something like that. While there wasn't any rally, said the Times, I couldn't help noticing two beefy guys speaking in Russian and laughing uproariously. Well, the venue here is called the Cutting Room, and the act coming on right after Lee Camp was a Russian rapper. And so it's very possible that the reporter who created the impression that these Russians had been there to cheer on Lee Camp got it entirely wrong. So I encourage you to read this and make a note to watch Lee Camp and support his free speech rights. Over the weekend, I faced a much lesser grilling, but on Facebook, a woman who I've never heard of, her name is Shelley, posted in reaction to my latest podcast, which was posted there on Friday. She wrote, "I really don't get why PBC is such an apologist for Russia. It seems very odd, and there is a lot of evidence for Russian hacking and also for collusion. I don't get why he's not seen any of the evidence himself yet, but it's very strange. I've seen plenty. Is PBC a Russian agent himself?" Now, this is the new McCarthyism. She thinks that I'm insufficiently supportive of the Democratic-approved and corporate media-embraced narrative that Russia hacked the DNC, Russia hacked John Podesta, Russia tilted the election toward Trump. I continue to be skeptical. I continue to demand proof. And for Shelley here to take a pot shot and question if I'm a Russian agent, well, that just shows how low we have gone. And finally today, Uber did make the change that we reported on yesterday. Travis Kalanick has been ordered by the board of directors to take a leave of absence and to retool himself. He didn't specify how long he'll be away, but he acknowledged that there is much to improve at Uber, and we'll see if he ever returns, and if so, in what capacity. Meanwhile, a report in the San Francisco Chronicle based on a new study shows the impact of Uber and Lyft on the streets of San Francisco, and the impact is very measurable. There are 170,000 Uber or Lyft local troops trips on a typical weekday. There are 570,000 vehicle miles driven on a typical weekday. During the peak rush hour in the afternoon, there are 5,700 Uber or Lyft cars on the streets of San Francisco. Now, this is producing a whole new level of traffic congestion in an area that already has very serious commuter trouble. And I know that for some people, they think, well, you know, an Uber car is going to transport 5 or 10 people over the course of an afternoon commute. And that replaces 5 or 10 cars that otherwise would be on the road. But because Uber resists any kind of regulation, I find them to be an irritant. And that Uber driver who almost hit me in San Francisco on Sunday is clearly still on my mind. Thanks for joining me for my News and Comment podcast today. It's available on YouTube. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.